Tonight on Arena, Oscar winner Morgan Freeman on acting, the blues and growing up in America's segregated South, and Ray Harmon on the film music of Hans Zimmer. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Morgan Freeman is best known for his captivating performances on the big screen, from his Oscar-winning role as Eddie Dupree in Million Dollar Baby and Nelson Mandela in Invictus, to God in Bruce Almighty, and of course, Red in The Shawshank Redemption.
Sometimes it makes me sad, though, Andy being gone. I have to remind myself that some birds aren't meant to be caged. Their feathers are just too bright.
We need inspiration, Francois. Because in order to build our nation, we must all exceed our own expectations.
A teenager who says no to drugs and yes to an education, that's a miracle. People want me to do everything for them. What they don't realize is they have the power. You want to see a miracle, son? Be the miracle.
People die every day, Frankie. Mopping floors, washing dishes. And you know what their last thought is? I never got my shot. Because of you, Maggie got her shot. If she dies today, you know what her last thought would be? I think I did all right.
Get busy living or get busy dying. That's goddamn right.
Morgan Freeman there in some of his great cinematic roles. But Morgan is not just a renowned actor and filmmaker. He is also a passionate advocate for blues music. In fact, he has a deep connection with the genre and opened a blues club, so-called Ground Zero, in Clarksdale, Mississippi, due to its proximity to the crossroads where blues legend Robert Johnson supposedly sold his soul to the devil. Morgan will join the RTE Concert Orchestra later this week as Master of Ceremonies in the Delta Blues Project, a concert which puts some of the greatest blues music ever performed into an orchestral setting. I'm delighted to be joined on Arena this evening by Morgan Freeman and the co-owner of the Ground Zero Blues Club, Eric Meyer. Morgan, you were born in the Deep South, and you can trace your family's history back to that area, to the area, in fact, where blues music itself was born.
Actually, my family history is rooted primarily in Mississippi. You know, the two arms of my family are both rooted in Mississippi. One's black, the other is white-based. My mother's side of the family are mulatto. As my great-great-grandfather was white and married my great-great-grandmother, who was black, in Mississippi. These things did happen in the 1800s. Voila.
The fact that you have that white and black ancestry, how unusual was that at that time in Mississippi?
It's very usual. If you look at black people and they're not black, they're mixed for the most part. That's how you can tell primarily, particularly West Africans, from American blacks. That we're like all most Americans, we're mongrels.
Let's go back to the 1937 and the Mississippi area that you were born into. What sort of society was that?
Well, I can't really tell you, Sean. In 1937, Mississippi, of course, we were highly segregated. As a child, I didn't have anything to do with it. I was not affected by it in any meaningful way. And left Mississippi when I was 6.5 years old, was gone for about 7 months, and then came back. I spent most of my formative years in Mississippi. It was a segregated society, But I had a good childhood, really good childhood. Great teachers, parenting, all that was all any kid would need to grow up.
Although you didn't meet your mother properly until you were 7.5, 8 years old.
Six and a half, right. I knew her the minute I saw her, but yeah, I was raised up until then by my paternal grandmother.
What part did music play in that early life? Were you aware of the blues music of the area, of the region?
I remember, I suppose, I don't know what you would call them, but if you had a drink of moonshine and they had a guitar, they would play music. And of course, it was almost always blues. There was nothing else to play. I didn't get into it properly until I was somewhere near my teens, you know, up around 12, 13 years old, when I came back to Mississippi to live full time. I had been in Chicago with my mom for, I don't know, 2, 3 years, something like that. Mm.
You knew, I think, even at that stage, that somehow when you were acting, you were at home in some kind of way. What did that acting kind of home, what did that feel like?
Well, I don't know. You know, when you find your niche in life, there was a kind of power that you feel, that you experience. This is where I'm very comfortable and have no qualms about what I'm doing here. I know what I'm doing. And that is always my life.
The music that you heard then, you said that it was really in your teens that you started to come close to it. Did that have any sense of I'm home, or was it, you know, was there some kind of belonging feeling within that music?
No. I within music, yes, but my musical tastes were rather eclectic. The only music that I've ever heard that I couldn't quite get into was opera. But everything that stems from the blues, anything, rock and roll, pop music, jazz, all have some connection to Delta blues, believe it or not.
I suppose specifically they all have a connection, many people would say, to Robert Johnson, who, let's face it, in terms of where you grew up, he's a local boy.
Yeah, he's a local boy. He was right around where I grew up, Greenwood, that area.
And the famous crossroads where he supposedly sold his soul to the devil, is that quite close by?
That was in Clarksdale. Clarksdale was like an hour's drive from Greenwood.
In fact, Sean, it's behind our club. It's virtually in the parking lot.
Behind your own, this is Eric Meyer now talking to us. It's behind that parking lot, that crossroads.
Yeah, so Ground Zero Blues Club. You know, story has it, and with some proof, that it's literally in our parking lot. So when Morgan and Bill Luckett co-founded the club, I think it was just incredibly visionary to put it right there.
I don't have to ask you then, Morgan, have you ever been to that crossroads if it's right outside your club? But I wonder what you feel about this idea that, you know, in fact, Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil so that he could play this great blues music. That's how the story goes. Do you buy that at all? Or is it, you know, just some sort of story around?
That's pure myth. For one thing, I'm not one who believes in the devil, for one thing. Selling your soul to the devil to play. You know, blues is actually called the devil's music by the clergy. It isn't. The blues is merely lament. You know, everybody's singing the blues they're singing about how sad they are that their woman left, or they're on the streets, don't have money, don't have a job. That it's all personal lament for the most part. B.B. King, really long. I'll be back on my feet someday.
What you've just done, Morgan, suggests to me that you should be singing as part of this concert that you're involved in. Will we hear that wonderful speaking voice of yours that we all know? Will we hear it in singing mode?
I don't. Probably not, really. I like to sing, but I cannot claim a real talent for singing.
If you're not going to sing yourself, then who are the touchstone? Who were the touchstone singers, Morgan? Who became those important blues singers for you? You've mentioned B.B. King there. I think that's important. Of course, 1987, U2 made a phenomenal version of When Love Comes to Town with B.B. King.
B.B. had a shortcoming, however, as a singer. He couldn't play the guitar and sing at the same time. He was a good guitar player, but he had to either play the guitar or sing. Couldn't do both.
Going back to Robert Johnson, he could play the guitar and he could sing at the same time. How subversive an act was it? You know, think about the society he was in. And I've heard the suggestion that, in fact, you know, when they say, my baby done me wrong, or, you know, don't want my baby to come back to me anymore, that's often about, in fact, the plantation owner or the boss. They couldn't say he because they'd be in big trouble. How subversive an act was it even singing a blues song in Robert Johnson's time?
Well, if the master heard it and understood it, it's very subversive. Otherwise, no, it's just it's like language, you know. I'll bet you know that the separation between the Irish and the English, the Irish had a conversational code that they could use. Same thing in the South.
Yeah, well, we had our own language that we could use that quite simply the English couldn't understand, but colonization meant we lost that language. Interestingly enough that you mention Irish, because if you'd read the Stephen King novella before you did Shawshank Redemption, you'd have been looking for an Irishman to play that part of Red. So you took that from us, Morgan.
Yes, indeedy. I didn't read the book because the first page of the book, it's described Red as Irish. I said, well, no, this is not going to, I'm not going to be able to do this. So I didn't bother with the book. I just stuck to the script.
As not a day goes by, I don't feel regret. Not because I'm in here, because you think I should. I look back on the way I was then. A young, stupid kid who committed that terrible crime. I want to talk to him. I want to try to talk some sense to him. Tell him the way things are. But I can't. That kid's long gone, and this old man is all that's left. I gotta live with that. Rehabilitated. It's just a bullshit word. So you go on and stamp your form, Sonny, and stop wasting my time. Because to tell you the truth, I don't give a shit.
I suppose that is ultimately what an actor has to do with a part. It doesn't matter about anything else. It is the script that's the thing. Is that always the starting, middle, and ending point for you?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. All my life. I got on the stage first time when I was like 8 years old. And, you know, it's like going back to the womb, right where I belong.
At the age of eight?
At the age of eight. Yeah. when I was 12 years old, we had this little contest. What's the word I'm looking for?
Talent contest or something? Was it a talent contest, something like that?
Talent contest of all kinds, yeah. But it would have music. We had bands going against each other. We'd organize drama things that we did. And when I was 12 years old, I won my first Best Actor award at age 12 in Mississippi.
Wow.
So, you know, and of course, everybody in school, I'm somebody.
And that award, in terms of the subsequent awards, including an Oscar, where does that award sit?
It's up there with the Oscar. I have this cabinet. Has all those.
Yeah. When you won that award at the age of 12, was there any comment on your voice? Now, it may not have dropped to the basso profondo that it is today, but was it?
No. I didn't start getting comments on my voice until after the electric company. But when I was in school, I went to college for about 20 minutes, figuratively speaking. And I was in the theater department, and I studied voice development and voice and diction. And I had a really terrific professor who knew exactly how to put a voice on a person. And that's where my voice began to be my voice.
And the Electric Company, of course, a famous children's television program in America in and around, I suppose, the 60s and 70s, was around about that time that it was on the television, maybe even earlier?
Yeah, 70s and 70, mid-70s.
Yeah. And you say that this teacher kind of found your voice. What about the accent? Were you speaking with a very deep Southern accent at that time? Was that molded out of you?
I had a deep Southern accent, and that got modified by him, because voice and diction is very important. That means no slurring, no eliding, hitting your final consonants as you speak, you know, stuff like that. So I got an actor's voice, which is not supposed to be regional.
Did that annoy you at the time? Does it annoy you in any way now?
No, not at all.
And in terms of when it comes to doing an accent then for a role that you might be playing, is that again part of the actor's tools and you just have to accept it and run with it and make it happen?
I'm not really that talented. I know actors who can just do voices or accents. It just make it easy. I can't do it. I'd have to listen to it over and over and over and over and over. I did manage to come close to Nelson Mandela in the film Victus, but that was serious study that got me there.
And I guess that's a different type of role from if there is such a thing as a normal role, but from a role where you're playing a fictional character, you don't have something that you have to emulate in some way. How important was it for you to get something close to the reality of Nelson Mandela's sound, Nelson Mandela's look, Nelson Mandela's walk, etc.?
Extremely. Extremely important to get as close to him as possible. What happened with Mandela was when he published A Long Walk to Freedom, he was asked by somebody in the press, and if your book becomes a movie, who do you want? Who would you like to play you? And he named me to do it. So the producer at the time, who had the property, his name was Anant Singh, put us together. I happened to be in South Africa, and I got to meet Mandela at his home in Joburg. And I said, if this comes to be, and I get to play you, I'm going to have to know you. So every time we were in proximity for years after that, we got together and I would hold his hand. That's just energy transference for me, the actor. If you're going to play someone, some real person, somebody you can get close to, it's best to touch them. It's energy transference. I think that works very well.
Our enemy is no longer the Afrikaner. They are our fellow South Africans, our partners in a democracy. And they treasure Springbok rugby. If we take that away, we lose them. I know. All of the things they denied us. But this is no time to celebrate petty revenge. This is the time to build our nation. You elected me your leader. Let me lead you now.
I'm wondering about energy transference between a director and an actor. You've spoken many times about Clint Eastwood, and obviously the best supporting actor, that Oscar nomination to match your pin from the 12-year-old acting for the 12-year-old actor, Million Dollar Baby, with Clint Eastwood, and later, of course, or earlier, Unforgiven, that version of the Western that Clint Eastwood gives us. How does the energy transference work between you and him, and a director? Actor, is it different?
Clint, I think he's an actor's director. I say that to mean that he doesn't direct actors. He directs movies. He hires actors, and it's your job. And I love that about him, that, you know, you establish your own character, you play it, and you do what the scene calls for, and I'll have the scene set up. Cameras will be where I want them to be. The lights will be where we want them to be. And go for it. He never says action, and he never says cut. He's his own person on the movie set. Wonderful. And I think I was probably, I begged him to direct Invictus, but it's one of the few movies he directed he wasn't in.
And again, vital to have him there, I would say. Did he support the way you approached that Mandela character very much? As you said, that energy transference of holding Mandela's hand and the like?
He loved it. He loved it.
You strike me, even as you describe it, and I know Clint Eastwood is one of these two or three takes, and that's it. If you haven't got it then, forget about it. It's not going to happen. Do you think that comes to a large extent? Your first big break in the movies, I suppose, was in your, I think you were 50 at the time. I know there had been an earlier movie, but all of your work, very highly lauded on stage. You know, you don't get takes on stage. It's go out and do it. There is no retake.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the way he operates is strictly on hiring, you know? Hire the actor you want and then let him fly. He's really good at that. And he's maybe my favorite of all film directors.
I guess for the concert, the upcoming concert then, is it a case of hire the musicians you want? Give them the music and let them fly. Is that part of what you'll be hoping will happen at this upcoming concert on Sunday next?
Well, yeah, I've never been to a rehearsal for a concert for an orchestra, you know, but I have watched some of the big ones direct. It's about the music, you know. I think probably you have to audition to get into a symphony orchestra. I'm not sure about that, but I would think you would have to audition. After that, yeah. I think they just let you interpret the music, but you have to be within really very short little parameters, because if you stand out and you're in the string section, wait a minute. I don't want to hear you. If you want a solo, we can work something out, but.
You want to hear the horns and you want to hear the saxophone, you want to hear those woodwinds. Is that what you're looking for in terms of blues interpretation?
Yeah, not in terms of blues interpretation. Blues interpretation, primarily, bluesmen are guitarists. Because you can't blow a saxophone and then sing. It's harder to do, you know. I don't know if anybody even plays the fiddle and sings.
There are a few, but they're rare.
Yeah, you know, so.
And Eric, you might explain to us how the blues music, the guitar music and the voice, how will that transfer into an orchestral style of music? How will that work?
This is highly unique to take a blues, you know, Delta blues songs and then infuse it with kind of the orchestral sound. So it's, we're excited. This is going to bridge really two generations, two styles of music. And frankly, you keep in mind, these blues artists don't really have set lists. They play instinctively. And so this is a very unique combination that I guarantee is going to just really dazzle the audience.
So we will have plenty of guitars, plenty of songs. Morgan, thank you so much for being with us this evening, yourself and Eric. We listen to some blues music to finish up, and looking forward to seeing you in Ireland on this coming Sunday, both yourself and Eric. Thanks so much for being with us, Morgan.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
Eric Meyer and Morgan Freeman there. What a joy and privilege it was to speak with both of them. Morgan Freeman will join the RTÉ Concert Orchestra. Continued celebrations of the orchestra's 75th anniversary. The Delta Blues Project is the title of Sunday's concert, June the 11th at the O'Reilly Hall in University College Dublin. You can find out full details on orchestras.rte.ie. Promised a little bit of blues to finish up with. What better than Muddy Waters?
One, two, three. I'ma thank the year above and round. I'ma thank the year above and round.
I'm a King Bee, that from Muddy Waters, but the King Bee that we were speaking to before that, Morgan Freeman, of course. And just to remind you, the RTÉ Concert Orchestra, the Delta Blues Project, Sunday, June the 11th at the O'Reilly Hall in University College Dublin. Morgan Freeman will be the MC for that event. Details on orchestras.rte.ie. The most notorious show of the year is finally with us. The Idol, a new six-part television drama starring Lily Rose Depp as a young American pop idol named Jocelyn, looking to relaunch her career following a nervous breakdown. Ahead of a new album on tour, Jocelyn meets Tedros, played by Abel Tesfaye, a shady nightclub owner with whom she begins a troubling relationship. Who exactly is this mysterious figure, and what does he have planned for Jocelyn's career? That's for us to find out. The Idol arrives on screen amidst a wave of pre-release controversy. The biggest question is this, though: is it any good? Chris Wasser has been watching it. He's with me in studio now. Hold off on the judgment just for a second. And let's hold off even on the controversy just for a second.
Sure.
What's it about, and who is this character that Lily Rose Depp is playing, Jocelyn?
Yeah, I guess the Idol is about a pop idol. Mm. And Lily Rose Depp is Jocelyn. We understand that she's had some level of international fame as a pop star. And that at some point along the way, perhaps during a tour, everything went sideways. Her mother died, which we haven't really gotten into yet, but we know that following that, her career, her personal life went a little off the rails. She did suffer a nervous breakdown. She spent some time in a hospital. And now, surrounded by a feverish team of handlers, you know, PR types, creative directors, a number of managers, a big comeback is being orchestrated. There's a new single in the pipeline. There's a new album, a new tour, which we have a Live Nation chief, you know, panicking about the concert tickets. So the big question is Jocelyn okay? And her PR handlers seem to think she's okay. Yeah. But we spend a little bit of time with her and we realise she might not be.
All right. But I'll come back to that side of the story as well. What about the Tedros character here? He sounds like the shadiest fella ever, is he?
I think when we first encounter Tedros, we know straight away he is bad news. The only way he could be more bad news is if he wore a sign saying, "I'm a bad guy." He
meets a bad guy written all over him.
He really does. I mean, everyone around Jocelyn says, "This guy is a bit icky. This guy's a bit iffy. What are you doing?" She meets him after a very long day of dance rehearsals, after speaking to a reporter from Vanity Fair, after preparing for a tour doing a photo shoot, and he runs a club in LA and he points her out in the crowd. He comes down to her, he demands a dance with her, and for reasons that are beyond us, the two of them are drawn to one another.
All right, let's listen to a clip. This is quite early on. I think it's possibly their first encounter. In fact, Lily Rose Depp is Jocelyn meeting Tedros, played by Abel Tesfaye. Big debate around pop music here. She's disillusioned, but he's playing the nice guy a little bit at this point in time. And I should warn you that in the midst of this nightclub conversation, there is a little bit of rough language.
When can I hear this new album?
Never.
Never?
No.
Why the fuck not?
Because it's like stupid and I hate it, and you're gonna hate it too.
You hate it? How can you put out something you hate?
Well, you obviously don't work in the music industry. Pop music is just superficial.
I think Prince would disagree with you.
I love Prince.
You're gonna call When Doves Cry fucking superficial?
No, I love that song.
Huh? If that song came out today, it'd be a smash tomorrow.
So all I have to do is make music like Prince?
I didn't say that.
Easy, I'll just do that. No. Why didn't I think of that?
I didn't say that. You can't make music like Prince. Pop music is like the ultimate Trojan horse. You get people to dance, you get people to sing along, to say whatever you want. Shit's powerful.
I like you.
I like you too. You got the best job in the world. You should be having way more fun.
That's Abel Tesfaye there as Tedros and Lily Rose Depp as Jocelyn in a scene from the new series The Idol. Chris Wasser has been watching it for us. Yeah, at the surface level, at any rate, he seems like a solid enough guy in that scene. It possibly gets worse after that, Chris, but she is whip smart.
She is, but he's also mansplaining pop music to a pop singer, which is a troubling start. And when they tell one another that they like each other, especially when we hear Jocelyn tell Tedros that she likes him, we've seen nothing from him before that to say, you know, that he's a likable character. You know, we just see her kind of, you know, getting down from his DJ booth and kind of almost literally climbing up on top of her and being all over her. And as I said, all of her friends and her handlers are saying to her, this guy is iffy, what are you doing?
Her friends and handlers, I'm not sure that I'd want all of them as my friends or handlers.
No. There are some problematic characters in here. We have one record label executive portrayed by Jane Adams. Her name is Nikki, and she is... she doesn't seem to care. She kind of makes light of Jocelyn's mental health troubles in the past, because we come into this photo shoot, and during the photo shoot for her new album, Jocelyn is wearing a gown and a sort of a hospital bracelet, so they're kind of commenting on what has happened to Jocelyn, but her handlers are making a joke out of it. We have another portrayed by Hank Azaria. He's one of their managers. He literally locks an intimacy coordinator in a bathroom and pays someone $5,000 to keep him in there because this intimacy coordinator is getting in the way of the photo shoot. That should give you an idea of what that
guy's
like.
Is there anybody her creative director, the Xander character, played
Xander,
is he a bit on her side?
Troy Sivan's a little bit on her side. You know, he kind of, you know, expresses his worry that there's perhaps a little bit too much nudity in the photo shoot, because Jocelyn, you know, it said in her nudity rider that there wasn't going to be. One guy who seems to be on her side, Dan Levy's another manager, who kind of, you know, maybe is kind of looking out for her, but they're all just trying to keep the money train going. They're all there for one reason.
All right, let's listen to again Lily Rose Depp. This is the photo shoot for the new album. Troy Sivan is there as Xander. But there's also that Nikki Katz character played by Jane Adams and Hank Azaria's Chaim, who's locked the intimacy coordinator in the bathroom. It's a disturbing discussion, this, in some ways. Let's have a listen.
But what is the image saying?
That she's young, beautiful, and damaged.
And not damaged. She had problems that she overcame beautifully.
Okay. The robe, the hospital wristband. I mean, are we romanticizing mental illness?
Absolutely.
And you're fine with that? That's cool.
You people are so out of touch.
Oh, here we go.
You people.
You college-educated internet people.
Okay, yeah, you're criticizing me for going to college.
Oh, will you let people enjoy sex, drugs, and hot girls, okay? Stop trying to cock-block America.
No, Nikki, I'm not some sort of prude. I just don't think that with everything that she has been through, she should be wearing a hospital wristband.
Mental illness is sexy.
No, it's not.
Yeah. If you live in Sioux City, Iowa, you are never going to meet a girl like Jocelyn.
That's the beautiful Nikki Katz, the character there played by Jim Adams, referring to mental illness as sexy. That's quite a disturbing type of debate, Chris, that's thrown up in the Idol. Is it dealt with in any way?
No, not at all. What you hear is what you get. And what I mean by that is we don't kind of delve any deeper into any of the discussions or any of the themes or any of the topics presented here. And there's a sense that the weekend Tess Fey was at one point saying that this show might piss people off. That's what he says about this. And that was kind of maybe the aim at some stage. You can tell that because some of the conversations coming off it doesn't feel as though they're part of a plot. It feels as though they're there to just antagonize people, which gets annoying.
And is that the controversy that dogged it, or are there others?
No, there are others, John. There's an awful lot of controversy surrounding this. The key issue being that around April 2022, after 4 or 5 months of production, HBO announced that there was going to be a massive overhaul on this show, and that 80% of it was supposed to have been done. We had a different director, Amy Semetz, it was running the show, and a new cast all of a sudden was brought in. Sam Levinson, who developed the show with Abel Tesfaye, he was brought in to reshoot, to rewrite, to direct. There were all these reports that apparently The Weeknd said that, quote, the show had gone too much into a female perspective and that he wasn't getting a look in anymore. There was an awful lot of bad reports about this.
And then there was the whole controversy at Cannes. Should a TV show be getting shown there?
There was that.
Is it worth watching, yes or no?
It's horrible. It really is, yeah. It tries to be a satire, but it's constantly explaining what it's trying to satirize, and that's not good enough. It's very badly acted. Lily Rose Depp comes off an awful lot better than Abel because she is an actor, but it's quite nasty and mean spirited, and I just couldn't get past that. I'd say give it a miss.
Give it a miss is what Chris Wasser is saying about The Idol, available on Sky Atlantic and on the streaming service Now. Celebrated German film composer Hans Zimmer comes to the Three Arena in Dublin next Sunday week, June the 18th. Fans will be treated to a selection of works from his vast array of movie scores. 12 Oscar nominations and 2 wins alongside a host of Grammy Awards. Hans Zimmer, probably the most successful and respected film composer of the 21st century so far. Ahead of this Three Arena concert, the series of the movies he has scored will be screened in the Lighthouse Cinema in Dublin and the Palace in Galway. Those films include Gladiator, Inception, My Beautiful Laundrette, Thelma and Louise, and The Lion King, amongst many others. But just some of those names alone will give you an idea of the breadth of his work. Ray Harman, guitarist, arranger and composer for both film and television himself, is with me now to take a look at the unique talent of Hans Zimmer. I mean, even as I read out that list of films, Ray, they're so different, all of those films, really. And that's one of the Hans Zimmer hallmarks, really, isn't it? He tailors the music to really to fit the product, the film he's scoring for.
Yeah, hi Sean. I really think he does. I think he's unique in that way. I mean, every composer, that's their job, is to try. Yeah, but he does it in a really interesting way. He does it in a way that is simpler, and just somehow does it in a way that's quite almost populist, almost like a sort of a Coldplay approach to it. It appeals to everybody, but it works brilliantly. It distills the essence of every film that he does, and sometimes so amazingly well that they become iconic scores.
And I wonder to what extent, you know, if I think of John Williams, despite the fact that he again tailors his product to the, tailors his music to the product, I'll always know it's John Williams. I'll hear John Williams in it.
Yeah.
Is Hans Zimmer like that, or is he more of a chameleon who can change from film to film?
I think chameleon's a great word for him. I think it's a really good word. I think one of the interesting things about Hans Zimmer is that he sees himself possibly less as a formal traditional composer and more as a really important part of the filmmaking storytelling process.
Which probably goes back to his training, which isn't the big classical background that many of them have.
He's no formal training at all. Apparently he says like 2 weeks of piano lessons and then he just sort of made it up. And actually he mentions somewhere in a TV show or a film that his main tool is a computer. So he's one of those guys that comes from that generation where he wasn't afraid, the line between traditional instruments and technology is blurred, and there are no rules in a sense, you know. So there's a great documentary where they call him a Hollywood rebel, and in that sense he sort of did break the mold when he went over there. And
that was specifically in that use of technology.
The use of technology and just his approach to it, no rules, and just go for it.
Gladiator, of course, one of the big movies that he scored. And this is big Hans Zimmer, I honestly. You know, there's big Hans Zimmer and there's small Hans Zimmer, if you like. This is certainly a big Hans Zimmer. Yeah. Now We Are Here, Hans Zimmer and Lisa Gerrard. Farrar just over the top there, that wonderful vocalese that she has in there. But I'm saying is that Ray Harmon with us this evening, looking at the music of Hans Zimmer ahead of both Hans Zimmer's concert and the season of films at the Lighthouse and indeed at Palos in Galway. I was saying as we were listening to that section from Now We Are Here, or Now We Are Free, I beg your pardon, from Gladiator, I was saying, Ray, that it really is a mix there. What you mentioned going into it, technology and orchestra, both are present in that piece.
I think it's really interesting about Hans Zimmer in that he's partly responsible for the sound of modern film scores, in that when he, in the very early days of technology, computing, sampling in the 90s, he went way ahead of everybody else and created these vast sample libraries where he would actually go and record his own orchestras so that he could manipulate them and play them on a keyboard. And the reason he would have done that initially was so that he could demo and mock up the scores for directors to be able to play them to them when they come to the studio, and it gives them peace of mind and they know what the eventual recording is going to be like. Then he will go and he'll record the live orchestra. What he did then was something really interesting. He mixed the two together. So the live orchestra would be augmented by these samples that he's recorded. And it gives us this, you know, present depth, and it's the sound of film scores to this day.
Yeah, and in fact, if you think the fact that because he moved to England moved to London, that was a big kick-starting point in his career, and he was involved there with Trevor Horn, who was the producer with the Bugles, and of course the one-hit wonder that was Video Kills the Video Star. But if you think of the type of production that was there, that's kind of what Zimmer brought then to film.
Yeah, in London, one of our great Irish composers was working in London at the time as a producer, Fiacre Trench, and he tells me that in those days, between the advent of MIDI technology where you could synchronize tape and computers, before that existed, the only person to go to in London was Hans Zimmer for a voltage control technology, where you could where it was the only method to synchronize computers and tape at the time. So he was the go-to guy. That's probably why he was there in that Buggles video.
There a type of a geek quality to him then in terms of technology?
Big time. He's a massive geek. Yeah, he's brilliant though. I mean, that's his thing. You know, I think he's very much a tech nerd.
So he would have loved something like the idea behind the film Inception, which is kind of in that technological world.
Yeah.
How well does his music match the idea?
Oh, I think it's beautiful. I think the Inception idea, again, it's a really interesting concept. It's a huge four chord, powerful, emotional thing that he's used from Thin Blue Line, from a lot of his early films. It's sort of a recurring thing. Very, very, very simple idea. And again, it's not necessarily a huge, memorable melody, but it works so well with the storytelling.
The storytelling itself is so complex. I'm not going to try to explain Inception in 10 seconds, because it is all of these parallel universes, things that may or may not be happening to the person. So I suppose to match that musically, you go one of two ways: either match it totally by being very confused, or match it very simply, which is, I think, what he does.
Yeah.
So it is really, that's Hans Zimmer's score for Inception, and Ray Harmon with me speaking about Hans Zimmer's film music this evening. And it really is a very simplistic, not simplest rather than simplistic, Ray. Yeah. But you were saying,
the emotional chord.
You were being very polite in the way you put it. He's a magpie, was that the way you put it?
Yeah, I mean, all composers are, right? And the reason they are a lot of the times is because temp music from other films is used during the editing process. So when the composer gets the final film, there's often a scattering of music used. So sometimes the directors and the producers particularly become very attached to that. You have to come up with something that's very close to the temp. And in fact, like a good example is that sounds to me very like a theme from Waltz with Bashir, a Max Richter score. But it's also true as other films as well. I mean, I think he uses it beautifully in Dunkirk, where he actually uses Elgar's Nimrod.
All right.
Used at a very, very slow place. Yeah. And what he's doing there is he's taking the audience's emotional baggage, their attachment to that Nimrod. Nobody is unmoved moved by Nimrod. Mm. And he's basically bootstrapping that onto the film. And it's brilliant. It's simple and it works instantly. And that's the job of storytelling in film, I think.
Yeah, then he gives us scores like this. Having a lot of fun, Hans Zimmer, there with the Jack Sparrow theme from Pirates of the Caribbean, which doesn't have all of the chutzpah, I suppose, of the main theme, Ray Harmon, but he's having he knows how to write a funny score.
It's brilliant. There's actually a lovely video clip of him online playing that phrase by phrase. And telling the story of, you know, how Jack Sparrow is...
And matching the movements, I suppose, of Johnny Depp, movements, et cetera. Yeah.
How he's a nice guy, but he's a bit of a devil. And you don't know what he's going to do next. It's a lovely little thing. You can check it out.
He also, his reputation is of being an all-round nice guy. We didn't talk about it with the Lisa Gerrard thing when we mentioned with Gladiator. But there was he really gave her a leg up when he could have just said, I know, I'll do this myself.
Yeah, he's interesting. I think he's genuinely a very outgoing, nice guy. Charming guy, but he also has this. The name of the studio escapes me now at the moment, but it started out as Media Ventures. Mm. And the idea was that it's almost like an agency, a composer agency, with him as the point man. And everybody that's come out of that studio, John Pell, Harry Gregson Williams, Raman Djawadi, they've all become huge Hollywood composers. And when they were working there, they were assistants, they were making coffee, they were sweeping the floors, but they often got, you know, jobs writing small cues. They wouldn't have got a screen credit, but they're on the cue sheets and they'd be earning well from that. So he's altruistic and he's a good guy, you know.
And very thoughtful as well. He worked with David Attenborough, I suppose, on the Planet Earth, on the second Planet Earth, on Planet Earth 2. Mm. How important is that kind of activism side to him? Is that a big part of him, Zimmer?
From what I've heard, yeah. I heard him quoted saying that he believes it's the best thing he's done. He feels it's a proper contribution apart from simply entertaining. So it obviously means a lot to him, and it's a wonderful music too.
Yeah, and are you as big a fan of the films as you are of the music?
Yeah, actually, yeah, I am. I love those big films, and he seems to be the man to go to for all those big
Hollywood numbers, big blockbusters. Yeah. Well, let's finish up with a little bit of Planet Earth 2. The iguanas are fighting the snakes here.
It's brilliant.
Not sure who wins, but the music is good fun.
A snake's eyes aren't very good, but they can detect movement. So if the hatchling keeps its nerve, it may just avoid detection.
Sounds like a bit of a car chase, but no, it's an iguana chasing a snake or a snake chasing an iguana. I'm not sure which. Ray Harmon speaking to us there about the music of Hans Zimmer. Hans Zimmer will perform live at the Three Arena in Dublin on Sunday, June the 18th. Series of movies he has scored is running at the moment at the Lighthouse Cinema in Dublin and at the Palace Cinema in Galway. You can find out full details on lighthousecinema.ie or palace.ie. And thanks to Ray for coming in to talk to us about that this evening. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening here on Arena. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Gar Duffy was the sound supervisor this evening. Michelle Gibson, the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.